Thanks for selling your car to Carvana. Here's your check.
Whoa, when did I get here?
What do you mean?
I swear it was just moments ago that I accepted a great offer from Carvana online. I must have time traveled to the future.
It was just moments ago. We do same day pickup. Here's your check for that great offer.
It is the future.
It's the present and just the convenience of Carvana. Sorry to blow your mind.
It's all good. It happens all the time.
Sell your car the convenient way to
Carvana.
Pickup times may vary and fees may apply.
Coverage varies by plan. View contracts and exclusions at endurancewarranty.com.
If you're driving a car or truck with an expired warranty and suddenly lost your transmission or needed a full engine repair, would a $4,000 repair bill leave you stranded? I'm Danica Patrick. Don't get caught off guard with a vehicle breakdown. Choose the company I trust, Endurance. No matter the mileage, if your vehicle is less than 20 years old, Endurance offers comprehensive auto protection plans for any budget. Protection on the drivetrain, electrical, transmission, AC, and more. Plus, benefits like 24/7 roadside assistance and rental car reimbursement on any plan. Endurance handles everything from making the claim through the repair process to paying the certified mechanic of your choice. Don't get caught off guard with a vehicle breakdown. Act now and get one full year of elite benefits, a $2,000 value, free.
Visit endurancewarranty.com for your fast free quote today. That's endurancewarranty.com.
Cameron, what is the last cardio workout that you did?
I did 5 miles on a bike 2 days ago. Inside.
And how many hours did that take you?
It took me 15 minutes.
15 minutes.
To be honest, I'm giving myself too much credit. It actually took me about 27 minutes.
What about the one before that?
I think 5 minutes on the Stairmaster.
Okay.
I've been doing cardio recently compared to the last episode.
Yeah, well, I think you got into some cardio when you and I lifted together because you were doing some seated dumbbell lateral raises. And your heart rate got up to like 160.
Yep.
So that's cardio.
Wow.
Yeah.
All right. And Mike, what was your last cardio workout?
Well, I lifted today and I did 20 minutes after the lift, just like as a cool down. But yesterday morning I did 16 400s with a 1 minute rest. And they were, the slowest one was 120 and the fastest was 72. And so flying 16 times.
And is that like mile pace or 5K pace, or what are you running those targeting at?
So those would be anywhere from like a 440 pace to just over a 5 minute mile.
Okay.
So one time around the track, 16 times with a 1 minute rest. And I did an afternoon bike just to get some additional cardiovascular
cross training. We're going to talk about cross training.
Oh, cross training. Get me all excited. Don't know what that is.
Cross training.
Oh, buddy.
Are you faster than Kyle at the mile?
We don't have to cut this out. Let's keep it in.
I think we should keep
it in. Oh, my gosh. Why would you do that to me? So I would say right now 100%. But we've done a mile, and I think he has beaten me. Yeah, I was not very happy about that.
So it just depends on the day.
Depends on the day.
Yeah.
When Kyle is in high rocks shape. But I think he's put on some poundage, so he may not be as quick.
Yeah.
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 But he's a very impressive human being, whether it be strength or cardiovascular. Like,
yeah.
How does the rhino run that fast for
that
long?
Big rhino.
The big rhino.
Yeah. I think it's because he has bigger lungs.
Could be a thing.
Yeah.
Well, what were his previous sporting experiences is what I think about.
Oh, cross country.
There you mm-hmm. go.
And track.
Well, and track. Exactly. So he knows how to turn himself inside out because for him, the mile, it was probably a low 5 minute mile, mid 5 minutes. So he does enough CrossFit to know that there will be an end, right? It's not a forever and ever. It's not doing an ultra race. He knows that there is a very defined, do 4 laps and then you're done. And then when he's done, he is done. You know what I mean? He will empty the tank. And I think that CrossFit, Metcons, track helps you with that.
Teaches you to really push yourself to the limit where you're like, you know, I have 0% left.
Correct.
After the workout.
I used to have a coach that would tell me that if you couldn't make it to the finish line because you didn't have the stamina, well, then he didn't give you enough endurance in your training. And if you went out too hard and you tapered, or excuse me, if you finished and you're like, well, that was cool, I could do it again, he didn't give you enough speed. So it's this beautiful combination of coaching, both anaerobic, speed, tempo, And endurance, it's the beautiful combination of those that when you cross the finish line, your tank is emptied.
Cameron, do you know what those words mean?
No, I actually zoned out a bit.
Yeah. All right. Well, let's go ahead and get to some introductions here. So we have Cameron Blevins back on the podcast. He is playing the role of our gym bro, and he's going to be answering all kinds of questions about running today.
Yep.
And then we have Mike Thompson, also known as Fat and Fit Mike. Fast and Fit Mike.
Oh, come on. Fast and Fit Mike.
That's right. Fast and Fit Mike.
On the Insta face.
Tongue twister. Yeah. And you are an actual run coach, and you've competed at a fairly high level in the past in things like Ironman, but I'll let you kind of list out your credentials.
Okay. Let's take it back. I actually played college soccer. So I played at Michigan State, graduated there with a degree in exercise science. After soccer, actually, so I played 2 years at a Division II school, Saginaw Valley, transferred to Michigan State because I knew I wanted to do kinesiology. And I played club soccer and I did club triathlon. And then I walked on and played 2 more years at Michigan State. But coming out of college, I ended up getting plantar fasciitis because I ramped up my running, which a lot of runners do. Got plantar fasciitis, and then I started doing triathlon because getting in the pool and getting on the bike can help your running. I actually fell in love with it. And so that would have been, I graduated in 2005 and then did some marathons, dabbled in some triathlon. 2010, I did my first Ironman, first and only, Cozumel, Mexico. I did a 1050. And I want to take a step back from triathlon and the distance of Ironman and do more Olympic distance, which is a 1500 meter swim, which is a 0.9 mile swim, and then a 25 mile bike, and then a 10K run, which is 6.2 miles. I got very competitive, actually took about 2 years to try and go pro in triathlon, hired a coach from the Olympic Training Center, and, you know, traveled around the country trying to get crazy fast and trying to get top three in a lot of races to get what they call your pro card. And so never went pro, wasn't the best swimmer. I could bike and run with the guys, the style of triathlon that I was trying to do. But a lot of these pros were previous swimmers. They would swim in middle school and high school, and they were like cross-country runners or track runners. And then they could develop the skill of biking, which there isn't a lot of skill to the biking, but there is a great amount of skill on the swim and the run. And so my coach would say that what they look for in the Olympic Training Center is those previous experiences. And so I made it to a world championship in 2012 in New Zealand, competed for Team USA as a elite amateur. To qualify for that at a national championship, I forget what my swim was. I think it was like 125s per 100 for the 1500 meter. I biked 24.1 miles an hour for the 25 miles. And then I got off the bike and ran a 10K at a 5:59 pace for 6.2 miles. So it was in around Lake Champlain. It was not flat. But my strengths were that quite literally I could at that time deadlift 400 pounds and that gave me the strength that I needed on the bike and to be able to have the strength that I needed on the run as well. So I think that's a cool kind of flex is I could do both of those, kind of the hybrid athlete, if you will.
Before it was cool. It was
really cool. Yeah. That's right. Yeah. The OG hybrid, you know?
Yeah. And for people that don't know about those, you know, bike times and run times, those are exceptionally fast, particularly that 10K you're closing at the end of the race. Yeah. So that for people that, you know, don't necessarily know, oh, is that a fast or slow that maybe are new to kind of the running world? Those are very impressive times.
Yep. That was what, 2012? Now it's 2025? Holy cow.
Time flies.
Yeah. And then along the way, I think I've done 20 plus marathons, a couple Boston marathons, Chicago marathon, like 9 times. Did a couple High Roxes, I think 5 or 6 High Roxes, one of them with Kyle as a doubles partner.
Yeah.
And 2 years ago, I did the Leadville 100-mile mountain bike race. That same year, I went 4:48 in the mile. So, you know, I actually just made a reel today on Instagram that when you train for a thing for a long period of time, specifically 7 years, you can see your potential in that sport. And I like to think that if I would have really put my eggs into a thing, I could have done some pretty amazing things, right? And after 10 years, my coach used to say, you reach that potential. So if you think about a gymnast who gets into the game at 5 or 6, at 16, they're kind of peaking or reaching their potential.
Sure.
Right? You can kind of do that for a lot of sports. But I think that's my personality, is I kind of dabble, and that's what kept me free from injury, is I like to lift, and I like to do some high rocks, and I like to do some triathlon. And
you weren't so hyper, like narrowly focused on one thing, and then you get an injury that holds you back from that one thing. Correct. And then a lot of people sort of hang it up there, crash, or can even get depressed if that's sort of what you've tethered your personality to.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And Cameron, I learned you were a personal trainer. Yep. I forget the organization, but what are your credentials and what does that organization teach about aerobic exercise or cardio?
Yeah, well, it was through ISSA. It's expired and I have zero credentials now. What it teached about aerobic exercise, to be honest, I can't really remember. But it was probably
typical
something along
gym, bro.
Yeah, it was probably like, something along the lines of just the basics.
5 minutes on the Stairmaster and 5 miles on the bike.
It was probably somewhere around the lines of just like zone one through zone five or whatever it is. Just simple stuff. Nothing crazy like what Mike's doing.
Okay. And Mike listed off a lot of like his accomplishments. What would you say is your best not weightlifting accomplishment? I guess you can say one of those, like if you have a deadlift or something you're particularly proud of, but your best weightlifting accomplishment and your best aerobic accomplishment.
My best aerobic would be in middle school when I ran a mile that was under 5 minutes, I think.
Wow, that's very impressive.
You sure that wasn't a 400? JK,
sure.
I'm joking.
I'm sure. Yeah. Now it's probably around whatever you got last year, 10 seconds longer than that.
That sounds like a competition.
Yeah. Well, I was competing with James, although he didn't know it.
Yeah, I didn't. He was behind me.
I was behind him the whole time. Weightlifting, nothing really too impressive, just across the board, pretty basic. What I said last time, though, was my biggest accomplishment in like the sphere of lifting or whatever would be the low body fat percentage.
Mm-hmm.
I got down to, on a DEXA scan, I think what was it, 6-something%, maybe 7, which I figured was particularly low.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's pretty lean.
A decent amount of mass, yeah.
Yeah, and we'll cut that part out.
Yeah.
And then how many years have you been training? Mike walked us through his training. What's that timeline been for yourself? Is that middle school when you picked up any kind of like exercise or specific targeted training?
I started training in 7th grade, like actually training, not just PE class or weights or whatever they want to call it. Which would have been 2013, I think. So I've been training since 2013.
Been training since Mike was competing in New Zealand.
Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah, it's funny. I saw a guy on Instagram this week who was on the bike putting out some big watts. And I went to his page and started scrolling, and he was on the Michigan State Triathlon Club. And so I messaged him saying, oh, dude, you're putting out good numbers. I was on this team back in 2003, realizing that this kid was probably not born in 2003. I'm getting to that age.
Yeah, it's wild. Like, what year were you born?
2001.
Yeah, this guy, we're from the 1900s. This guy is born in the 2000s.
Century.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it's wild to think about. Now there's people born, like, in the 2000s, people that weren't born when 9/11 happened. Just time has flown by.
Yep.
So now I'll ask this question. You guys can answer in whichever order makes sense. But what is the most fun distance to race in running?
I know what my answer is.
I would say the 1 mile. Do I need to give an explanation? I'll always lose. Unless it's like a endurance thing against regular people, not like you guys, like any of my friends that I race, I'll always win that. So the funnest race to race is the one you know you'll win.
Okay. What do you think, Mike?
My favorite race is the one that I'm training for.
Which is that?
Wherever I'm at right now. For example, right now I'm training for a half marathon.
Okay.
But, you know, 2 years ago I trained for the mile. I would have loved to be training for the mile, but we're taking a family trip to Colorado during the 1 mile race this year. So my goals have changed a little bit. Like I've actually got a 100-mile bike ride race in June, gravel bike race, Unbound in Emporia, Kansas. And then I've got Rock the Parkway, which I would love, love, love to set a PR, which would be sub 120, which is about a 6:05 pace. And then I've got the Chicago Half Marathon in May, which I wrote that program. So I'll go up there and I'll actually coach and do a shakeout run. And
yeah, I've seen you do those before social media. Pretty cool.
Yep.
So you have clients running that race as well?
Oh, yeah. Clients all over the country. Yep.
Really?
Do you have any clients running in that race, Cameron?
I don't think so.
All right. Now let's get into like some controversial topics. And I don't care who answers first here, but is running bad for your knees?
Ooh.
I would say inherently it's bad for your knees.
What does inherently mean?
It is bad for your knees.
Okay. Any explanation or that's all the explanation that's needed?
I think that's all that's needed, but I could go further, I guess. I think that much weight and pounding over time for that consistent amount of time, the longer you do it, the more damage it will occur and accumulate over time. That's my opinion.
Okay.
Mike, what is yours?
That you are incorrect.
I am?
Yeah, no.
Hit the incorrect buzzer there.
Yeah, you know, and it's not just because I love running and I've done it. I think I like this quote, running doesn't give you bad knees, bad running gives you bad knees. And what I think about to elaborate on that statement is that you can run, but you cannot run like I run. Like maybe what you should do is that, like if you were to get into running, you would run 2 minutes and then you would take a 2 minute walk 10 times. So for that day, you are only running 20 minutes, but you get 40 minutes of work in. 2 minute run, 2 minute walk. And what happens is during that 2 minute segment, your running form stays fresh because your brain thinks that I just need to get to 2 minutes. And then once you reach that 2 minute mark, you reset, you get your breath, you kind of let your energy system recoup, and then you're like, I'm good to go for another one. And so I think that me as a coach, finding what is appropriate for the athlete is what my job is.
But isn't walking during your runs considered cheating?
No.
It's not.
Yeah, no, it can be a good reset. And there's actually a coach, Jeff Galloway, who actually has a walk-run program and has had a lot of success with that. Mm-hmm. And I, even myself, when I've had some, you know, aches or pains or stepped away from running and maybe did a little more biking and came back into running, which hasn't been very much, but even I've added walking into my program, and I would consider myself, you know, fairly advanced. And so I think there's a time and a place for it. And that could be in the heat. That could be if you are stressed. That could be if you got a lot on your plate, stressed, right? So I think it's knowing the intensity at which you should run, meaning the pace and the duration. So I think if you understand those things, and then if you can get somebody to take a look at your running form and to critique some small things. It could be the way your arms are swinging, or it could be how fast your legs are moving, that it can bring joy to you when you actually do run.
Now, is that applied the same to a treadmill?
Yes.
Like, your opinion still goes on a treadmill too?
And do you have to set the treadmill to an incline so that it's not bad for your knees? Or so that it mimics your natural running form more?
So what I think you're asking is that a lot of people talk about putting the incline at one. And what that accounts for is that you aren't running into wind.
The wind resistance.
Yes.
Gotcha.
So, yes, you will probably have a little better foot strike with a little bit of an incline. It'll put you into a natural forward lean position. So that shin angle will be more vertical, but the foot will be more underneath your body at contact. It's almost like if you were to put, conversely, that treadmill on a decline, -3, and you're still vertical with your spine, the tendencies for you to strike out in front of yourself is probably great. Okay. So yes, if you were to put it at like one, I think that that can help get that foot underneath the body and improve your foot strike position.
What's more dangerous, running outside or running on treadmills? Because I've seen some people wipe out on treadmills and get thrown into walls, mostly like children on funny videos.
Yep. But
what do you guys think?
I think there's a different...
It depends on where you're running.
Like if you have your treadmill up against the wall. So it's like, I know if I don't keep my pace up, I'm going to get slammed into that wall.
Yeah.
There's different textures, right, outside. So concrete is the most hard. Asphalt next, like a gravel or a dirt. So I think that if some of my athletes have soft tissue issues, it can be a great bridge to concrete, right? So let's say you're racing the Chicago Marathon. What are you going to run on? Concrete and asphalt. You got to be able to do some of your training on that. Mm-hmm. So it's not just like, okay, game day, go ahead. I know a lot of people that have run on treadmills. For example, Paula Radcliffe, former world record holder. She's an Englishwoman in the marathon. And she ran on the treadmill a lot because she had bone density issues, but she also ran on what's called an Alter G, which takes load off you. She basically ran in like a bubble. And so she ran through, she was running with those mechanics, but it deloaded her from as much the impact.
Yeah, I just learned about these. They can take up to like 80% of your body weight off, mm-hmm. like just with the air pressure they manipulate it.
Really?
So they can make you weigh like 40 pounds. If you weigh 200 pounds,
so it's a great
theoretically
way of doing a return to run program
in like a 1% increment, so you can sort of taper up without re-injuring yourself.
So right. Think about that with treadmill, dirt, or grass or turf,
mm-hmm.
and then asphalt. And if trust me, if you run enough and you run on concrete and then you run on asphalt, you can tell the difference. So concrete is the most hard. So not all surfaces are the same, like, density.
Yeah. Now, if we're getting into some of the fundamentals of training, like someone's getting started, and I see this a lot. People are like, okay, well, before I get started, I need to figure out what watch I'm going to get, what shoes I'm going to get, what heart rate monitor I'm going to get. Do people need those things to get started, or do people get hung up on those things when they should just focus on getting started in the first place and then add those later?
Would you like to take this?
Sure, yeah. I don't think it matters what they get. I can understand how it'll help someone if, like, just like how if you sign up for a membership, you're like, well, I'm paying for it. I have to go. If you get yourself, like, a nice running watch, a Garmin or an Apple Watch, and if it helps you stay motivated and you can look at it and you're like, oh, I've only got a mile left in my run, and that helps you stay motivated in whatever you're doing, I think it's worth getting. I don't think it's necessary at all.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, I don't think you need all the bells and whistles. I actually coached a he was a Puerto Rican gentleman, Sam Vasquez. He ran in London. He didn't make it out of the initial trials, but he ran with a Casio watch. He ran with a Casio watch.
Yeah.
And he never had a GPS system, and he ran based off perceived effort. He was a 401 miler in high school. He was a phenom. He was supposed to work with Alberto Salazar. And it was the fastest runner I'd ever worked with, and he ran with a Casio watch, you know? So I think the more miles you put on your legs, I think, yes, you should diversify your shoes. Like, you should not have the same shoes because you'll eventually have the same wear pattern in that shoe. So it's nice to diversify the wear pattern and even the, like, density of the shoe. So I think you should have an easy shoe, like a tempo or a speed shoe, and then a race shoe. So I used to have when I played soccer, I used to have my game shoe, you know, when I put it on. Or, like, if you're a track athlete, you have your track spikes.
Yeah.
When you put them on, it's game day. You know what I mean? So there's good psychological benefits to putting on your race shoe.
It's like the pre-race ritual part of that. It kind of gets you in the right mindset.
Yep.
So you heard it here, folks. The Casio watch is the fastest.
You can find me at Fast and Fit Mike for... With, yeah.
Comment in the description. All right. So what does a weekly split look like for you? Because you're still in this hybrid athlete space. So, you know, you talk about, you know, lifting and then the aerobic work. And, like, Hyrox is a pretty balanced approach. You have to be pretty strong, and you also have to have really good aerobic fitness.
Yep.
Whereas CrossFit is more on the strength and power output side of things. So what does, like, an average week look like for yourself? How many times are you training aerobically versus strength training? Are you doing 2-a-days?
Yeah. I'd say most days I'm probably doing 2-a-days. I like to start with the first part of the week, Monday. I like to do the most neurally taxing speed work and the heaviest lifts on that day. Starting Monday with a speed session, true speed, like probably like 400s or less. I like to do that when I'm fresh. And then in the afternoon, ideally, I get my heaviest lift, big compound, hex bar deadlifts, pull up with load, push press, bench press. Could be like an 8x3 protocol, okay, 5x5 early in the season, but it's a true strength protocol. As I work towards my race, I tend to pair power movements after those strength movements, contrast protocols. Tuesday tends to be an easier, longish day, so anywhere from 8 to 10 miles run. And then if I've got time, I can get some easy cross training in the afternoon. Wednesday tends to be kind of a deload or a cross training day. It could be an easy run, could be an easy bike. I still could get some good amount of training volume in, but it truly should be zone 2 and not be pushing the pace, because Thursday I have a tempo or a track session again. And then I like to do my second lift after that, not right after that, but ideally sure. 6 hours after, to get a couple meals in between, let my nervous system recover. Friday, I tend to pepper in some core, like structural balance movements. And then it could be a shorter cardio session on the run. And then Saturday, I tend to go long. Sometimes I'll put some tempo efforts or like app marathon or half marathon efforts worked in. I will not put speed in on that day. And then on Sunday tends to be like my long bike day currently.
Okay. Gotcha. And you're not putting the speed in on that Saturday because you know you've got that coming Monday and you want to be fresh for that true speed work.
Correct.
Nice. And Cameron, what does your split look like? And after hearing that, how do you think you could improve it?
His?
Yours.
Oh.
If you think he could make some improvements, I guess we're open to that as well.
Yeah, I can always make improvements in your split. My split currently looks like Monday through Friday is all strength training. And then at the end of that, I do some low-intensity cardio like Stairmaster.
At the end of Friday or at the end of each workout?
At the end of each workout.
Okay.
And I'll do low-intensity cardio. Sometimes I peek into zone 4 just because of how out of shape I am currently. But I'll do like the bike or whatever that – what is that, the salt bike? Salt bike, so that's kind of zone 4, but you can also go slow on it. And then I'll do Stairmaster, which is usually around zone 2. For anywhere from 10 to 25 minutes.
What's your current goal?
7% body fat.
So more aesthetics than
aesthetics. Yeah, I strictly train aesthetic than
like
actual endurance. Like I know I'm going to be able to run a fast mile comparably to like the rest of the United States.
Yeah. But I think it's good to state what your current goal is based off your split, you know?
Right, yeah.
Like you're not jumping into 5K.
No.
But we're talking about cardiovascular work.
Stairmaster is the best way to train for a 5K.
I am doing a 10K now at the end of this year.
Okay. Yeah.
So are you going to train for that?
No.
I'm going to
train.
10K.
I will train for it.
Okay. I know a guy.
Yeah, there's a
me too.
A
I
local
actually,
run coach.
Yeah. It's pretty good.
Yeah. So I hear.
Or you could always just have AI write it for you.
That's true. We should have pulled up AI and see who has a better split.
Oh, hey.
Let's see. Running causes the most injuries out of any exercise. True or false?
I would say true.
Out of any exercise or any type of workout? Probably true. I'd say CrossFit, but CrossFit isn't a exercise.
Yeah, but it's also a trick question, right? Because by the numbers, that's the exercise that the largest number of people do.
Yeah.
So is running a safe way to build your, I should say, can it be a safe way to build your cardiovascular health and aerobic capacity, or is it too dangerous?
I'm pretty opinionated on that. I don't think that people need to run. I think that there are other tools. Like, for example, I work at Lifetime. It's like the Disneyland of fitness equipment, right? So you got your skier. Your
it's a roller. Magical place.
It's beautiful. And maybe everybody's smiling there. It's great. Stair steppers. Bikes, so I think that you don't have to run to get the cardiovascular benefits. Walking is great. You know, this is coming from the run coach. So if your goal is aesthetics, you don't need to run. Stair stepper, walk, ruck, you know, ride a bike. I'm actually doing a 60-day challenge with some of my clients right now. I got people out on bikes. I got people walking, you know, tracking their steps. That stuff all is important. But I think that when you're specifically trying to improve your cardiovascular health, let's say you get a VO2 max test and you're trying to improve that number, I think what's important is to identify what your maximum aerobic heart rate should be to squeeze as much of the lemon out of that zone as possible without spilling into that. So you mentioned that you sometimes get up into zone 4. I don't know if that's accidental or on purpose, but if you're there's a lot of benefits to staying in that zone 2, you know, for women that might have thyroid or adrenal issues and not sliding up into that zone 3 where there's different stress hormones, and maybe skipping up into zone 5 where you're doing the high intensity work. The low intensity work is good. The high intensity work is good. Not to say that the zone 3 is bad, but if you are a stressed individual, it can be one of those areas that's like, ooh, you better be careful in that zone.
Because even though exercise is, you know, stress relieving, your body is still going to perceive that as a stressor.
Correct.
So it all sort of adds up. And you can see that in lab work a lot of times with athletes that are doing significant mileage. You know, they'll have elevated cortisol, or maybe their TSH is creeping up where they're maybe undernourished, maybe overtraining, maybe a little bit of both.
Yep. Actually, just got done teaching a class, and I was telling the class the reel that I just filmed about celebrating your sleep score. That's how I think that we should make that cool. And there's a great quote that I like to use. It's that there's no such thing as overtraining. There's only under recovering. So our bodies are pretty phenomenal. And if we are sleeping and we're doing hyperbaric chambers and we're doing all the things like to the nth degree, our body can do a lot. You know, that $1 million man who's trying to live forever. He's doing everything.
Taking LeBron all the vitamins. James.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Taking all the vitamins, doing all the things.
Yeah. He's one
I feel like there's
the,
an inside joke here that I don't know about.
He's one of the athletes that they both like landed on the same number of how much they spend per year on their bodies.
Oh, one looks no like an athlete, way. One looks like an alien.
Yeah. So like I think, you know, Brian Johnson's was $2 million per year, and I think LeBron James was basically the same number or something in that ballpark.
Yeah. It's impressive what he's doing.
Yeah. Yeah. But both of them. I guess it's very interesting. And I wish we had LeBron James's like protocol as detailed as we do Brian Johnson's, right? That would be really interesting to see.
He'd probably be kicked out of the NBA if we got that.
No, there's therapeutic use exemptions for everything.
Well, there is.
But anyway, moving on. What do you do if you see someone with bad form? You know your way around the weight room and running, and you know your way around the weight room. But if you see someone running or lifting with bad form, when do you like intervene or say like, hey, bud, you want some pointers?
You want to take that?
Yeah. I'm pretty sure last time I said I want to make sure I stay saying the same things. whenever I feel like they're going to actually get hurt. If it's bad form where they're not going to get hurt, they're just kind of doing the movement wrong, who am I to interject? I'm also not a trainer at the gym. But if I feel like the person's going to get hurt or it's obvious that they're going to get hurt, obviously I think the right thing to do is to interject and tell them, hey, you're doing that wrong.
So like if somebody drops the bar on their chest and they can't get it off, you're going to walk over to them and say, hey, you're not doing that right.
Yeah.
You're supposed to push it up,
to push
off,
it
your
up
chest.
Off your chest.
Okay. And what's your style?
Well, I work at the gym, and, you know, I can specifically think of a young lady that was benching, and I walked over to her after she got done benching, and it looked like she was – the bar was like this.
Oh, wow.
It was cockeyed, and it was a young lady. And I said, oh, my gosh, I love that you're in the weight room. Gave her a compliment. And then I said, do you mind if I give you a tip? So it's a compliment sandwich, right? So compliment, give her the information.
Been hanging out with Kyle.
And then
send
her off.
He likes compliment sandwiches.
Yeah. But I asked her what she was training for. She was a young soccer player. I'm like, you mind if I give you a tip? And I was like, you probably should like load up. And then I actually put her through a session. I had a conversation with her. I'm like, hey, would you ever let me put you through a session? Because the trainers here, everybody gets a pre-session. I'm not sure if you've had yours, but I'd love to show you a couple of tips.
Yeah.
That's one example. Okay. And then there are people, and I don't have any problem speaking to anybody because I don't know. I just got such a passion for it, you know? So like if someone's knees are doing something funny or if somebody's like squatting and they're wearing running shoes, which could be a whole other topic right there.
Ooh.
You know? So if they're squatting in running shoes, oh, I'm cramping. I just give like little gems, little tidbits. You know, like, hey, you mind if I give you a little pointer? Like, pop those shoes off or put a little plate underneath your heels because it looks like you're not getting the range of motion or, you know. So just like a little tidbit to kind of elevate what they're doing. Like, I'm not trying to take anything away. Let's just like put a little bit of the good stuff on the top, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. You're always kind of peppering in. And like, if people just go and look at your Instagram, it's like every day or almost every day, there's like a little tip or something insightful or something that you're doing as far as training. And I think really the only downside is now my warm up is 3 hours long, but no, in all seriousness, it is good information that you put out and little things you can rotate in and rotate out depending on, you know, what you're trying to do. Like if you're like, oh, maybe my core could use some work and strengthening that.
Sure.
And maybe that's a question, you know, do you need to do any direct core work, thinking in the like running world, right? So there's people that say, well, if you just do heavy squats, then your core is going to be strong enough. Is there anything specifically you need to do for your core besides that in the running world to support sort of being upright and bouncing along for however many miles?
Yeah, 100%. I think I can think of specifically, I'm coaching a elite high school soccer player right now. And he tends to go into a lordosis position where his sternum rises up and then his low back kind of pinches or stabilizes for what his abdominals are not doing. So some of it is I cued him to keep this rib cage down, but he actually needs core work to make sure that he can maintain that posture. Okay. So oftentimes people are like foo-fooing actual sit-ups, but the rectus abdominis does prevent extension of the spine. Okay. And then there's other things like the TBA, which can help brace, right? So I think understanding what each abdominal muscle does is important. And I'm a big fan also of doing like side planks, because I think that the internal and external obliques, if those are strong, I think that the glute, that lateral aspect of the body, tends to function really well. For example, I will sometimes see people pushing a sled and their pelvis is all over the place. And if you can coach them up on maintaining and bracing through their TVA and think of their hips is moving like pistons by keeping their trunk strong, that can therefore carry over to running because they understand how to engage themselves when they take that same concept to running.
Well, that sounds like you're improving the efficiency of the movement. You're going to have less power or like loss of that rebound momentum if Right. you're firing like a piston, to your point, and not just sort of tilting back and forth, wobbling, creating a lot of extra motion. Cameron, do you agree? Do you think that you need to do anything for abs for running?
Well, at first I was going to say no, but now after he's explained it, I think so. I think yes would be, you should do some core work for running.
And how much? Go ahead.
I do come from a, you know, pull-ups. If you actually put electrodes on your abs when you do pull-ups, there's a significant amount of stimulation that happens in your abdominal wall when you do them. But I think that there is a time and a place to do your planking and to teach your body how to create tension.
And you're talking about measuring electrical activity, not correct. Putting like a TENS unit on your abs while you're doing pull-ups.
That's correct. Yeah, to see how hard they contract.
That's what
contract.
I thought first, honestly.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, that's all I have to do to get abs.
Yeah.
Just put my little patch and do that when I'm doing pull-ups.
Yeah.
How much pain should you feel when you're running?
Like muscle and joint pain or like lung pain?
Interpret it however you want.
I think if you're running, you're seriously training, on a scale of 1 to 10, it should probably be, I don't know, like five or six.
Okay. Every run, every day?
No. But like if you're I don't know. I'm not in the running world. Maybe a 4. You should have went first, so I could just copy.
What do you think, Mike?
So I think there's a spectrum. I think that there's, I don't know about physical pain so much as like psychological pain. And I coach my athletes up on visualization and being ready to get into the hurt box. And like I talked about, when you cross that finish line, you have emptied the tank. And if you aren't mentally ready to empty the tank, it's really hard to go there. Okay. And so I think that there's psychological pain that you have to be able to endure. And then I think that I think the physical pain comes in the burning of the legs, right? The breathing heavily, the uncomfortableness of it. But there shouldn't be a stabbing pain in your knee because you did the foam roll for 4 weeks, you know. Yeah. That'd be bad, you know. And at what point do you need to stop running if you are experiencing that pain? It's so case independent, you know. But I think on your easy runs, like, you know, I listen to podcasts, I listen to books on tape. I'm not listening to bangers. I actually made a reel about that. Like this, if I go off for a 16-mile run, don't start with your bangers. Start with your podcast, the Gillette Health. You guys ever heard of this Gillette podcast?
It's the only one I listen to.
Yep. On repeat.
I keep it on repeat at home. I walk home. It's already on the TV going.
Hey, honey, yeah. The next one's here. It's your background music when you have like people over on Friday.
Yeah, that's
nights.
Right. I was like, oh, what's this? Oh, I didn't know this was on.
Oh, there's Kyle and I.
You have 5 new messages. Hey, Carl, it's Jen from Finance. Could you submit your expenses this week? Hey, Carl, happy Friday. It's Jen, Finance. Just need those receipts today. Me again, Carl. Really need those receipts, like last week. Please just tell me where they are. Are you by your desk right now?
Finance teams, you shouldn't be chasing down Carl or anyone else. With Ramp, expenses are sent with a text and reminders happen automatically. Switch your business to ramp.com today and love finance again.
Thanks for selling your car to Carvana. Here's your check.
Whoa, when did I get here?
What do you mean?
I swear it was just moments ago that I accepted a great offer from Carvana online. I must have time traveled to the future.
It was just moments ago. We do same day pickup. Here's your check for that great offer.
It is the future.
It's the present and just the convenience of Carvana. Sorry to blow your mind.
It's all good. It happens all the time.
Sell your car the convenient way to
Carvana.
Pickup times may vary and fees may apply.
You've done it again, finance teams. You closed the books, and it went fine. Sure, some expenses were missing receipts, but that's fine. Stayed late to process invoices by hand. It's all fine. But don't you deserve better than fine? With Ramp, expenses are submitted with a text, invoices are coded automatically, and everything is connected to your accounting system, so you can close the books without all the busy work. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.
Again, whoa!
Might as well just all watch it.
It's like the algorithm knows what I like. Yeah, no, I think that's good advice because there's a line between like your body telling you something's wrong and what's expected there. Like, you know, certain portions you're going to have some pain. Like if you start off with your bangers and you're listening to your 5 bangers on repeat for 16 miles, that could be some psychological pain.
Yeah, that could be. But it kind of desensitizes you. So when you actually do need them, you don't respond as much to them. So my post was you start with your books on tape or your podcast or no music. And then you go to music, you know, like bluegrass music is what I jam to, or like some smooth jazz, you know. I'm just kidding, but not really. But like you're not going to your bangers quite yet. And then like maybe the last quarter of it where things are getting a little tough, your legs are getting a little heavy, that's when you go to
hit your boost,
you know,
button,
like your Taylor Swift's and stuff like
right.
that.
Right. Yeah, yeah.
And what do you define as an injury? I'm going to read 2 definitions here and you can tell me which one of these is appropriate. So any injury sustained during training that prevented the participant from training, working, or competing in any way for any period of time, or it's only an injury if I saw a doctor for it.
Number one.
Any injury. Interesting. Have you ever seen a doctor for an injury?
No.
Yeah, Kyle Gillette.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. Good doctor.
Had some PRP on my knee.
Yeah, how's the knee?
I was having some odd cramping in what I thought was my popliteal muscle on the back of my knee. And it just kept like tightening up. And I didn't know if it was guarding because of a meniscus issue. And we never fully identified it, but it healed in like 24 to 48 hours. Like it was I mean, it was amazing. It was very good.
Little hint. It wasn't the PRP. It was the Kyle Gillette.
Ooh. Yeah.
Enter Kyle's face next to my shoulder.
We need to get an effect in there. We'll let our editor know. How important is flexibility?
There's so many layers to this. Like your questions, golly. So dynamic flexibility is very important. Static flexibility, like the sit and reach, is important, but is not necessary. So when you move you need to be able to move your limbs through full range of motion when you're moving. And if there is something that is limiting that, then that becomes an issue. So I think that there is a time and a place for static stretching. If you've got a real issue in your hips, issues in hamstrings, I like to add a little bit of load to it, like the Jefferson curl or like, okay. But yeah, flexibility is very important.
And then Cameron, I'll ask you, and I'll specify that I was referring to the ability to flex. How important is that?
It's extraordinarily important. You're not going to know how big you've gotten if you can't go in a mirror and flex.
That's right. Yeah. Especially with your goals being cosmetic aesthetic.
Yeah. Cosmetic and aesthetic.
But I like to do that. I throw out a broad, open-ended question that could kind of go a million different directions and just see where you guys take it.
Well, that is an interesting question for an aesthetic individual. How much do you stretch, and do you find that certain things are, I don't know, overhead pressing, is that a limiter? Like do you stretch your lats?
If I put a sticker in the middle of your back, could you take it off?
No. I could probably take it off. Yeah, I could. that only means I haven't gotten big enough.
But that's the measuring stick.
I don't stretch that often.
Yeah.
But I do warm up. But I do my most stretching when I'm doing legs.
Okay.
So I think that's the most injury prone. Especially if you don't warm up properly because you do the most weight. But for like, so tomorrow I'm doing arms and back with Derek. There's not going to be a lot of stretching. But there will be a lot of shoulder warm up, just light weights. So we'll throw in a little shoulder work. But not a whole lot of stretching though.
Yeah.
What about, I'll ask the short question and then I'll expand upon that. Does cardio kill your gains? Talking about muscle, and then at a higher level, talk about this concept of training interference.
Okay, training interference. I love that one. Does cardio kill your gains? Once again, there's a lot to that. I think it depends on how much you're eating as well. But I think that if you focus, for example, for yourself, if your goal is aesthetics, gains, right? He's trying to put on muscle, trying to get strong, trying to keep a lean body composition. I think that could benefit him if he is doing zone two appropriately. I think if he starts putting in too much HIIT and high intensity, and after all of his sessions, he's empty in the tank, burning up his glycogen stores, I think it could. I think that if he's managing his intensity and building it slowly, progressive, I think it can be beneficial for his heart health. I can think it would be beneficial for metabolizing fat, specifically after. So it can support your gains if done appropriately.
And what would be a rough percentage? Let's say someone is training. They're doing, I don't know, say 5 hours of cardio with, let's say we put a 2x multiplier on their high intensity stuff. So if they're doing some intervals or repeats at the track, you know, maybe that's 30 minutes, but you're calling that an hour. So their training load is like 5 hours per week of aerobic.
Okay.
They're lifting 3 times a week. Is there at that level compared to someone who's doing maybe 15 hours of aerobic work, is there a percentage difference in their ability to accrue muscle, I guess, in your experience or in your opinion?
Yes. I do believe there is.
And what is that exact percentage?
I mean, I think that what is limiting the potential to get strong and the potential to have muscle is just time. If that person is doing 15 hours of cardiovascular work, I think of myself as, I mean, the last couple of weeks I've done 12 to 14 hours of training, literally. And I'm sneaking in my lifts. I'm trying to do everything I can to maintain two lifts, right? I could not do four or five lifts. I just don't have the time to be able to do that. Mm-hmm. So I think it's just very difficult to add that in with my current schedule. So,
sure.
Because things start getting taken out if you're putting that much cardiovascular work in. So there are individuals that have the time and recover really well and eat the right macros, right? So the first person that you said, I think that person that's doing a lot of high intensity work also needs to make sure they're putting a lot of carbohydrates in, right? To support what they're doing for their intensity. Like I think of a lot of CrossFit individuals who go paleo and like cut out all of their carbohydrates. Oh, yeah. And they cut those carbohydrates and they go low carb or keto. And that could be very hard to maintain those gains because a lot of their work is high intensity. So for someone like yourself, if you're going low carb, then your cardiovascular work should match that. So it should be like lower intensity. Whereas if you were doing higher intensity, more like Metcons on the back, then you would, I don't want to say deserve, but you require more carbs or glycogen for fueling.
Yeah, we never have to worry about Cameron going low carb. He's a huge fan of Smoothie King smoothies, which have lots of carbs.
No carbs, just carbs.
He likes the ones that have only sugar and actually no protein. We pulled up the macros and it was like, you get the largest one, it's like 200 grams of sugar and nothing else.
Yeah, it's pretty bad. I don't drink that. I honestly do not think cardio kills gains.
Show me where on the doll the cardio killed your gains.
I can't show you anywhere. Didn't kill my gains. I think it matters. I don't think. I also don't think the zones matter. What zone you're in kills your gains either. I think it strictly comes down to is if it's getting in the way of your strength training or just training in general, as in weightlifting, and if you can make sure you're getting in the right macros or at least calories.
So sort of piggybacking is like you're not necessarily overtraining, but you can under-recover, under-nourish.
Yeah.
And talking a little bit about nutrition, I know in a previous podcast we raised the question of, you know, can you just eat big to get big? And I guess as it applies to running, can you just eat fast to get fast?
Oh, man, I think you're onto a marketing thing here for my 30-day – food log.
30-day eat fast to get fast program. Yeah. Get my ebook.
Can you eat fast? Are you? Is this a real question or was that just a funny statement?
It's a funny question. It's a question and it's funny. But I don't
know what it is.
To be clear, I don't actually believe that eating faster will make you run faster.
Okay.
That'll turn you into fat and fit, Mike.
Yeah. But as far as nutrition goes, like how important is the let's say like take the race, right? So you're going to do a half marathon. What does your fueling look like, you know, before that, thinking even like days before that week during the race and then like in your recovery from that race or those races?
You know, I did Leadville mountain bike 100 mile race. It's actually about 105 miles 2 years ago, 2023. And I think that opened up my eyes to how many carbohydrates bikers are consuming per hour. And I started implementing that on the run. And I've had less delayed onset muscle soreness ingesting carbohydrates during my run and prior to my run.
Is that on easy days or all the days that you're running or just for
mainly
the high effort?
So I think of stress. And stress can be done with intensity and duration. Hmm. Okay, so the greater the stress of the workout – so stress of a two-hour run could be very stressful. So, yes, that would require some carbohydrates. So I limited the delayed onset muscle soreness, right? Helped with recovery. So prior to a half marathon race, 2 days prior, I'm generally carbing up. And that could be my lunch and dinner. And then the day before, my lunch and dinner, I'm having more bolsterous doses of carbohydrates, less purine, meats, limited fats, limited fibers. And then the morning of, very simple. My go-to has been two pieces of toast, a banana cut, little slivers, and then honey drizzled on that with some almond butter on the toast. That's been my go-to. And then that's generally 2 to 3 hours prior to the race. And then right before I'll do a bar. And then say right before, it'd be probably like an hour to 45 minutes. And then I'll be doing my, I'll have done pre-workout. And then during the race, I'll for probably a half marathon, I'll probably do 2 to 3 goos.
Yeah, and are you doing the goos with caffeine in them as well, or just the carbohydrates?
I can, yes. And I do like the caffeine. I definitely wake up and have coffee, which helps with the bowel movement. Yeah, I guess it depends on what goo I'm taking, but definitely for a marathon, I'll have somewhere in there a goo with caffeine.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then, Cameron, what does a pre-workout meal look like for you? Let's say you want to for sure get a good pump in the gym. Mm-hmm. Right. And that's like your goal is like, I want to look bigger than I ever have before. So does that, is that just the meal before you work out? Are you eating anything different the day before?
No, definitely not the day before.
Yeah. You just carb load for a week straight.
I mean, probably.
That's right.
Something with a lot of sodium. If I'm bulking, then I'll just do like rice and then whatever snack I could find in the pantry.
Probably a smoothie from Smoothie King.
That would work, actually. A lot of sugar.
Just add some sodium to it.
Yeah, that would work. Right now, like I'm about to go to the gym, we finish this up, and I'm going to go do legs with zero food in my stomach. And then I'll do cardio too, high intensity.
Holy cow. Did he not just hear what I was talking about, killing those gains? No, I'm just kidding.
Well, I mean, I'll replace it later.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But if you want my honest answer,
have fun.
D-ball and Anavar.
Keeping your legs small. D-ball and Anavar together?
Sure, why not?
And you putting that in the rice or in the smoothie? Or
yes.
How does one prepare that?
Yeah, I usually hide it in the smoothie like a dog, like in a tree.
So you have like 7 smoothies lined up in your fridge, and a couple of them have D-ball and Anavar in there, but you don't
know
which ones.
You don't know until after you get to the gym.
Okay. Yeah. That's exciting. Yeah. Let's see here. What about running while bulking? So if somebody wants to add some muscle mass and also maintain or improve their running and aerobic shape. And I know you've done this. You've added a significant amount of muscle mass over the last several years. So what has your experience been like that? And, you know, what do you generally recommend for people who are trying to kind of balance the two?
Good question. I would lift before I ran to not take away anything from the lifting. So the lifting becomes your sport. Getting strong becomes your sport. So you do the first thing first. You have the most energy. I'd make sure the frequency of my lifting was high 4 to 5 days a week. And I'd make sure I'm refueling. Like you got to have the products. You got to have the fuel. So, yeah, I think I'm actually down 10 pounds from High Rocks just from the increased movement and have not been focused so much on the lifting and getting strong because of my now goal, the half marathon and the bike race. I'll probably do High Rocks in the fall. But, right now you got to make sure you're keeping that frequency up if you want to get big and fuel the beast, you know.
Yeah, and it doesn't behoove you to have 10 extra pounds that you have to carry, you know, over 13 miles during the half marathon. So being a little lighter and preserving the strength actually works to your advantage. Is that correct?
Correct, yeah. And the lifting I'm doing is definitely not doing biceps. I'm not doing anything to pump, if you will. I'm doing, like, for example, today's main set was a hex bar deadlift for 5 reps, 6 box jumps. And then I did 5 to 6 push presses into a dumbbell bench press, 10 reps very fast, 50 pounds, 10 reps very fast. I think that was done in probably...
So 10. Lift fast to get fast.
Yes.
Or does that one work?
That could, yes. I do think that there is some good correlation there. And then I did 5 pull-ups. Started with like 25 pounds, got up to like 45 pounds.
5 sets of pull-ups?
There's 6 exercises in a row. So I do them in pairs. So hex bar deadlift, box jump, and then like a 30-second rest. And then I go push press, bench press, paired up. And then I do a pull-up into a body weight, an inverted row, fast, 10 times. So,
yeah, so you're pre-fatiguing the muscle group each time before you go on to that second exercise in the superset.
I would say stimulating.
Stimulating.
Yeah. So it's not like a post pre-exhaust. It would be like a fire up that particular muscle fiber. Because
you're not pushing to like borderline failure. You're just waking it up and focusing on the power output more. Correct. So. Okay. Interesting.
So why are you doing overhead press fast?
Excuse me, I asked the questions here. Sorry. Why are you doing overhead press fast?
Well, I'm glad you asked that, James.
Great question.
Yeah, the push press is actually I push pressed up fast and I eccentrically lowered slow. So okay. I think I had like 125 on the bar and I did use my legs and a lot of that was I also do that actually for a core movement. Because of the amount of axial loading.
Mm-hmm. You have to control the weight. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So that's why I did that one.
See, I thought you were talking like how the CrossFitters do it, where it's just as fast as you possibly
can.
Oh,
no, yeah, no, not one after the other.
Okay, that makes sense.
To failure.
That makes sense.
I have a video. Let's
that see. Makes sense, okay. Oh, yeah, that's bad. Yeah, that makes sense. Is this today?
Oops.
Yep. And you're just firing faster, and doing
firing fast,
fast yeah. reps.
And really, you could do this for, you could do that movement, second movement for reps or time under tension. You would not want it to exceed 20 seconds because you're getting that buildup of lactic acid. You're just trying to go, 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 go. Come on, come on. Let's get it. Get, go, 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 go. You're trying to get as many reps and move as fast as possible.
And you're doing that
for performance
and running?
Mm-hmm.
The bench?
Yeah.
You're so confused. You're like, not for hypertrophy? Like, what is this?
Yeah.
Big chest?
You know, some of it's the more I read about lifting, it's also just benefits your hormones too. You know, so.
Yeah, I'd argue almost any exercise does that.
Sure. Yeah.
Any exercise.
Oh.
Yeah.
A ultra marathon?
No.
Don't be silly. Oh.
Any of the regular exercises. Even if you've never exercised before, but just walking would probably help. If you're overweight, start losing weight.
Yeah. Yeah, and you do want to give your body a stimulus, like, you know, doing something hard, like a big compound movement like that, right? Your hex bar deadlift, you're engaging a lot of muscles, your body says, oh, we're using this thing. We need to keep it in top-notch condition. We need a stimulus to hold on to this muscle.
Yeah, and I'm not when I had put a couple additional OBs of muscle on, I was doing time under tension. I was trying to hold load on my chest. I was bench pressing to be under tension for 30 or 40 seconds, which I think is very important for hypertrophy. But as of right now, like I said, that is not the goal. Like my goal is not to hypertrophy. The goal, like whenever I'm doing sprints on bikes, like it's crazy how much you actually use your upper body grabbing the bike.
Oh yeah. Like the assault bike.
Or
are you talking about like on a bicycle, pedal bike?
Like an actual bicycle. Yeah.
Okay.
So like if I'm trying to keep somebody's wheel or trying to do a sprint finish, because I'll do some of these group rides and guys will get a little squirrely. There's something called Strava and people are trying to hit Strava segments and just kind of a fun way to train with a group.
Yeah, I suppose that makes sense if you're kind of leaning forward, putting a lot of weight on the, you know, the handlebars, and you are using your upper body, not just your legs.
To stabilize, yeah.
Yeah. What about volume increases with running? So let's say somebody does start running and maybe they switch it up on the running on concrete and then they get some shin splints like that. And they still want to run. They still want to train. They know they don't need to push it. But is there a reasonable volume increase per week or a reasonable way to gauge intensity to where they can still train, still be a little bit sore, but not dig themselves into a hole where they're like chronically, you know, nursing an injury of some kind?
So if somebody were to come to me and say that, I would say, okay, so in terms of the how much should people increase their volume?
Let's say this person is running 20 miles a week is sort of where they're at.
Yeah. I ask, how many weeks have you been running 20 miles? So if it's like, oh, I've been doing this for 3 weeks. generally early on, you can make larger increases in your volume. Mm-hmm. And then it kind of tends to plateau. And that could be 20, maybe 25% if you're like brand new, like a little baby giraffe, just finding your legs. But after you've been in the game for 4 to 6 weeks, I think that 10% increases are about what you want.
So if you're you've been running for a year or longer or a couple of years, then you wouldn't make a jump. Let's say that person's doing, you know, 40 miles a week. You would not make a 25% jump. It would be, okay, you're going to make a 10% jump in the volume, that sort of thing.
And you could do that accidentally, and you could do that maybe at a training camp where you get a super compensation, but you would have to come back down the next week to absorb it.
Gotcha. So it's not a 10% multiplier every week because that wouldn't be sustainable. But there's a specific goal in mind when you are pushing up that volume. Like you said, the super compensation, and this is quite some time out from a race.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear that. We ask it again?
So there's a specific purpose for that volume increase. Like you said, the super compensation you're trying to get, which is going to be, you know, quite some time out from the race. It's not something you're pushing the volume going into a race.
No. Yeah, that would not be intelligent.
kind of shooting yourself in the foot. And people that have been shot in the foot.
Yeah, I mean, I think about, I got a number of athletes doing the Boston Marathon, and they will, you know, kind of go 18, 20 miles, 16, 20, 21 miles, 16. You know what I mean? So it's kind of like two steps forward, one step recovery weekend, you know, and maybe on that 16, yes, their volume comes down of overall miles run, but maybe we're putting a little bit of marathon pace during that. So I manage their stress. Like I said, stress doesn't just come with duration. It also comes with the intensity, which you run those 16 miles. So a lot of times those 20, 21, 22 mile runs are easy because they are very stressful. So when you come back down to like a 16, come back down, you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
Come back down to a 16 mile run, then you can increase some of the intensity in that.
Yeah, that makes sense. And what are your biggest injury prevention tips? Like if it's to say somebody is new to running or experienced to running, I've heard you talk about cadence and a number of things, but if you had to pick like a, maybe we'll do like a top five so we can get a nice reel here. You know, what would you say are your top few or top five?
Keep your run frequency. I would say keep lifting in your program. I think a lot of times people take it out. I've actually heard people say, I'm running, so I don't need to lift, right? I'm training my legs, so I don't need to lift my legs. Okay. So I'm like, oh my gosh, smack my forehead, right? So I would say know your zones or know the paces that are appropriate for you. Because a lot of times when you run in that kind of hard zone, your foot strike gets a little bit faulty or a little bit goes rogue. And if you're running in the true zone too, you're having conversation, you're playful, you're in control. But when you get up in that zone three and zone four, you start to lose a little bit of control. And it takes a great amount of focus. And if you're doing that too much, too many times in the week, that's bad news bears. That could increase injury. I would also say getting in a good pair of shoes and rotating them often. So, you can get away if you're running one or two times in the week and you're only doing 2 to 3 miles with a pair of beat-up shoes that you mow the lawn in. But if you're going to do 4 or 5 times, or if you're going to come and run with us at the track, you need to be in a proper pair of shoes. And if you're going to run 4 times in the week, you probably should have additional pair of shoes as well. Those are the ones that are just coming to my mind right now. Yeah.
Yeah. I think those are all good tips. And is it okay to train in plated shoes every time? Or should somebody really have a non-plated shoe they're running in from time to time? Because I see this debated all the time on Twitter, and I want to know, like, what does an expert think?
That's a fantastic question. And, okay, so a plated shoe would be like a carbon-plated shoe. Generally, it's a race shoe. And my belief is that it is a very sexy, high-speed shoe, okay? One of those things that you put on, it's like race day. And a lot of times people save those things for race day and never really train in them. And I think that as we get close to our race or our competition, we need to be in them during our race-like workouts. And that would be your long run or a tempo run. Because oftentimes what happens is people save them for the race, or they may wear them two other times in the week or two other times in training. And then they go and race in these shoes and their body or calves or whatever isn't used to this new stimulus. Mm. And so they end up cramping because the new muscles that are being stimulated are fatigued in a different way. So I think that there should be some training in that shoe prior to competition. Now, I think that training in that shoe on the regular is okay. A lot of those shoes are comfy and cushy and have some good return and pop. So it can be kind of protecting the feet and limbs and knees and stuff like that. But I like to get into a generally a more stable shoe for my long runs, almost like to get a new stimulus to make some of those other muscles work. So kind of diversifies the foot strike and the diversifies the muscles that are being used. So if you're always using that, always using that shoe, you don't train those other muscles. For example, like this week, I actually went out to Shawnee Mission and I did some trail running.
Okay.
And I got a little bit of lateral movement. And I think that it was fun. It was playful. I was like, you know, like quite literally jumping over rocks and getting some lateral movement. And I think that that's a great way of, I think of if this is the hip and this is the angle at which we always hit with a particular shoe, you put a different shoe on, it hits this way. And like trail running would be like, you know, so it kind of strengthens all around and the hip and the foot. And so I think the more different angles that you can strengthen around theoretically the body, the better you're going to be, the more resilient you're going to be for that sport.
Yeah, I think that makes sense. Because if you have, you know, a stride, you miscue or misstep, you're fatigued, you're in one of those higher intensities, but you've put the time in and done some of that training on like a trail, then you're probably going to be able to recover from that, or your body can react to that miscue better than if you haven't done anything besides, you know, running in a straight line on concrete the whole time.
There was a podcast I was listening to about biking specifically, and there's these bikes called fixies, one gear. You get on that thing, and generally you're riding at a lower cadence, but when you're really moving fast, your legs are going to go faster than normal. Generally, a general cadence is anywhere from 80 to 90 RPMs, revolutions per minute. And so when you're grinding or having a low cadence of, call it like 50, 55, 60, it does strengthen the legs. And then when you're going very, very fast, so it actually increases your range. So when you're biking, when you go to 110 RPMs, it's not this foreign thing. And so with running, if you get these different foot strikes or different stimuluses, like I think it's just, it's good. That's why I think hills are, I say hills pay the bills, you know?
Yeah.
And it's like low grade strength training for runners. Getting that new stimulus.
Yeah. Cameron, have you ever run in carbon plated shoes?
Nope. I think the weirdest shoe I've ran in is an NMD.
I don't know what that is.
It's like an Adidas, kind of like a flat shoe.
Is it a barefoot shoe?
No.
A keto shoe?
No.
Definitely. Paleo not. Shoe?
No. Kyle showed me his carbon plated shoes. They look very uncomfortable.
He now has carbon plated shoes for every exercise, I think.
Probably.
He has carbon plated shoes that improve sleep quality.
Yeah.
No, not really.
He would.
He would, though. If they made it, he would have it.
Yeah. So there's performance enhancing shoes now, and that's like really interesting to me.
To the point where they are illegal if they have a certain
stack height. It's above, what, 40 millimeters or something like that.
That's crazy.
Yeah, I've seen some of these. They literally look like cartoon, like spring loaded shoes.
Yeah. And there's some companies that are just still making them.
Mm hmm. Yeah, because if you're at a local 5K park run, somebody's not going to be checking your shoes probably. But if you're at the Chicago Marathon checking in, they're going to be like, Mike, what you got on there?
I don't know. I mean, maybe if you're winning money, like if you were
sure. Yeah, if you're going
to
be.
Or if you were to be in contention for something like world major, you know, top 100 athletes in the Masters category or something.
Sure. Yeah, that's interesting. And back in your Ironman days, I mean, performance enhancements, were there people using performance enhancing drugs that talked about it, or people not really doing that? Because I think the training you're putting your body through, I don't think anyone is going to be operating in an optimal state. And obviously things like, you know, EPO or things that stimulate EPO like testosterone, if some percentage of those people are using them, it's probably not zero, but is it like more of a hush-hush thing? Or is it like if you're in that club, people kind of talk about it? Or what did that look like?
I think that there was definitely conversations. I never knew any of those individuals. But it was more like with the elite. Sorry. It wasn't elite. It was actually the age groupers. So with the pros, they generally got drug tested.
Mm-hmm.
But like in age group races, they didn't. So, but nowadays I am hearing a lot more TRT, peptide use, which rock and roll, man. If you're not taking cash home and, you know, like if you're just like the weekend 5K half marathon guy, yeah, rock and roll, be healthy.
Yeah, and I think it could be, you know, especially if you're a Masters Ironman athlete, like you probably are going to do better with a normal healthy testosterone than a hypogonadal testosterone level, mm-hmm. like in terms of like keeping your bones strong and your ability to recover from the exercise. And again, like there's rules around the competition. Like if you are using that and getting a leg up, there's a whole ethical question there because you're turning yourself to normal, but the training is sort of what put you below normal with your levels. Are you familiar with this enhanced games?
I've heard of it, yeah.
Yeah. What do you think about that? I mean, specifically for like track and field. I mean, it's interesting to me, but as someone who like actively competes in running, what do you think about that? If they were to add like a mid-distance or even like a half marathon?
I think it's interesting. I haven't thought much about it. I'm trying to think what podcast I don't know if it was Andrew Huberman or Peter Attia.
Joe Rogan had him on.
Maybe it was Joe Rogan.
Yeah, he had a couple of the, I guess they're the founders or the guys at least promoting it.
Oh, you know who it was. It was Andrew Huberman. He was talking to the sprint coach,
mm-hmm.
and they were talking about those games. I always think back at the SNL skit where like the guy was deadlifting 1,800 pounds and his arms continued to hang onto the bar. And his arms broke off and there was blood squirting out of his arms. I've talked to professional cyclists that have been on different substances and ripped muscles off their bone because their muscles developed faster than their ligaments could tolerate it. And that individual ended up biking the rest of the race with one leg. Not making this up.
Wow. That's some grit.
Yeah. So he literally had to bike because his quad tore itself off the bone. So I think that we're probably going to get a couple of those things in those races, right? Mm-hmm. Which could be interesting and entertaining if you're into that stuff. But it would also be crazy to see what the body's potential is.
Yeah. And I think my speculation, and let me know what you think about this, the first year, I think it'll be a little bit underwhelming. I think people are going to like bandwagon onto this hype around it and think that, you know, world records are going to be broken, you know, with a little asterisk there, just right. like your home runs for certain right. baseball players, but that world records will be broken. And I don't think they'll get broken the first time they do it. I think that it will be in those subsequent years when, you know, maybe somebody's like, well, I'm past my prime competing naturally.
Oh.
And it's mm-hmm. like an elite level person that then sort of retires. Yeah. But goes to this.
So like a Noah Wiles in like 6 years.
Yeah. Yeah. So if he hits whatever age and he's like, now I want to like see what I can do with these enhancements there.
Yeah.
And if he doesn't go to the enhanced games, then we know he's just already enhanced. You wonder what
the different types of like sponsors that would be a part of that, you know?
Oh, that'd be interesting. Yeah. Who's going to like, who would run the commercials?
Yeah, right? Exactly.
Yeah. Men's TRT clinic.
Bud Light. Yeah, who's the big rep now for Bud Light? It's the
Shane Gillis.
It's like one of the, is that what it is?
Shane,
yeah. Okay. Yeah, he did one with Post Malone, I think.
Post Malone, that's what I was thinking about. Yeah. Like how they can't like drink on the commercial.
Yeah.
Yeah. They're wearing jorts. I don't think that'll be a part of the games.
Yeah, probably not. All right. Well, is there anything that you wish I would have asked you, either one of you guys, in this conversation? Question you're just dying to answer.
Give me a second. I think running is a great thing. I think it's a beautiful thing. Coming from a run coach, I don't think that people have to do it to achieve optimal VO2 max numbers or cardiovascular health. But I think that getting support is a great way of expediting and reducing people's potential for injury. And I think that your question about does running give you bad knees? I truly believe that running doesn't give you bad knees if you're doing it in a safe environment. And that might be for an individual running on a treadmill for 30 seconds and then walking for three. That could be it. Okay. But we have to find that person where they're at. And so I think that getting some support, whether you reach out to me and ask a question, you can find me at Fast and Fit Mike on Instagram. But yeah, no, go to my Instagram page. I put a lot of tips and tricks up there, and I do that to get the word out. Like, for example, today I just filmed about how to find your the high end of your zone two through your breath. I found another post about how to find your lactate threshold. Your lactate threshold and your ventilatory threshold are very closely correlated. So your breathing can be a very good gauge or governor to find those things. And yes, metabolic testing is extremely beneficial, and it tends to be the gold standard, but there are a lot of more elementary things that we can do for free if you administer a proper protocol. So that's why I just try to get the word out there that there are these protocols that you can implement, and they work, you know? So I think that's all I got to say.
Yeah. So if you made it this far on the podcast, thank you for listening. Thank you for your time. You can find him at Fast and Fit Mike, or you can find him at Lifetime most of the time. He's walking around, smiling, talking to people. He's a very social guy, so don't be shy. Say hello. And we thank Mike for coming on. It's been a pleasure having you. And we thank Cameron for coming on. And we hope your workout goes well later.
It should.
Let us know if you implement some of these tips or decide to do a little bit more cardio. Maybe you feel inspired today.
Maybe a little bit, yeah.
Hey.
I might get on that treadmill.
Oh,
I definitely will not do that.
Yeah, so we'll see. Next time we'll ask Cameron how his workout went. And this may be months from now, so we don't know if we'll even get an answer.
I don't remember.
But leave any comments or questions you have below, and we do look at those and revisit them from time to time in podcasts. We appreciate all comments, whether they're nice or mean or nasty. Just leave comments. It helps the algorithm. And as always, thank you for watching, and may God bless you with health and happiness.